WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We were saddened by the recent news of Rosemary Clooney's death. We'll remember her on Friday with a concert and interview that we recorded on stage in San Francisco. My guest today has been tracking a global business that is not traded in the stock market, heroin. Matthew Brzezinski wrote last week's New York Times Magazine cover story, Heroin, the Sleek New Business Model for the Ultimate Global Product. Brzezinski is a contributing writer to the magazine and a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal. His book, Casino Moscow, is a tale of greed and adventure on capitalism's wildest frontier. It just came out in paperback. Brzezinski followed heroin from the cultivation of poppy crops in Southeast Asia through the drug sale on the streets of American cities and suburbs. He says that this year, Afghanistan will have a bumper crop of poppies because when the Taliban were overthrown, it brought an end to their prohibition against growing poppies. And he says, despite the military and security measures taken to fight international terrorism and shore up America's borders, the global heroin industry has had a remarkably good fiscal year. Has the business changed a lot since there's been a lot of new security measures established after September 11th?
Well, interestingly, I think it's a little bit early to say what the long-term effects will be. In the short run, right after 9/11, talking to border guards and customs officials here in the United States, they were very surprised. They said that all of a sudden things became very, very, very quiet. And they didn't see any drugs whatsoever. And they're usually at the big borders along, say, the California border with Mexico, for instance. They're usually making a dozen big seizures a day. And all of a sudden, there was nothing. And it was as if the smuggling syndicates, the drug runners, were hanging back and waiting to see what would happen. And so far, there's been a dramatic rise in seizures. But again, that could be misleading because part of the reason there's been such a dramatic rise in seizures since 9/11 is that passenger traffic everywhere was way down. And this gave customs and border guards the opportunity to screen every entrant entering into the United States more carefully.
Now, you say that the business of heroin is structured a little bit like terrorist cells. Make that analogy for us.
Well, any drug organization, but particularly heroin, can't operate like a normal business venture in that it cannot be vertically integrated. It has to operate sort of horizontally, in that you have to have a lot of sort of what I would call freelance contributors that only specialize in their particular niche in the entire distribution and supply chain. And there can be no one big boss. It's just a whole bunch of players who have a common goal. In this case, it's to make money. It's greed. It's not a political statement like or a jihad or a war like Al Qaeda. But they get together and they will move a certain product and then they will disband. And then the next time they want to move more product, they'll get together again very briefly. And this is all done so that the different players don't know who they are, and you can never break more than one link in the chain. So you can never bring down the entire organization if somebody gets caught. And I think we've seen that as well with Al Qaeda and all sorts of terrorist networks. When you bring down one cell, you don't bring down the entire organization.
Now, how does heroin sales compare to cocaine in the United States? Heroin has its kind of ups and downs in terms of distribution and demand in the United States. Where are we now?
Heroin is actually picking up a lot of ground on cocaine. We've been seeing a decrease in cocaine use in the United States and a change in demographics in that fewer users are using it, but the users that are using cocaine are using more of it. In other words, they're habitual users or they're addicts, whereas we're seeing much more recreational use of heroin. And in a sense, this is sort of the opposite of the introduction of crack cocaine, if you recall, in the 80s, which took what was essentially a yuppie drug and opened it to the mass markets, to people with limited income and disposable income. What has happened now is heroin was traditionally injected, But now you can, because of increases in purities and the way it's distributed, you can now smoke or snort heroin. So you're having alarming trends, such as teenagers now are snorting heroin, and heroin is very, very addictive, much more so than cocaine, so you're seeing a change in demographics.
Probably a lot of teenagers assume that if you smoke or snort heroin, it's not addictive. It's not the same as shooting it.
Right. I think that there's a misperception there. And of course, there's no stigma of HIV or AIDS that one can get with a tainted needle.
So it's part of like the marketing design here to keep heroin affordable enough so that you can find new teenage markets to sell it to.
Well, there's a whole price range for heroin, and there's different varieties of heroin, and that is part of the sophistication of the industry. And when I went with the undercover police, the narcotics squad in Baltimore, to buy heroin, I was very surprised that it came in vials with different colored caps. You had pink caps. This was the cheapest sort of snorting heroin. This was targeting teenagers, kids from the counties, as the police referred to them. You had red caps, you had blue caps, you had green caps, which would then increase in purity and price. So you could have up to 40% purity, which is a very, 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 very strong dose of heroin.
Who does that go to? Who's that for?
That is for people who want to smoke it, again, or snort it. But this is for people, this would be, you know, your doctors and lawyers. It's unlikely that addicts could afford to pay $40 for a milligram of it. They'd probably pay $10 for a milligram of what's called scramble, which is 4 to 7% purity, but that you inject it directly into your bloodstream, so you don't need it to be as strong. And in fact, this is where you get overdoses. And in the 90s, when America was inundated with heroin, when the Colombians decided to go to switch partly from cocaine and start producing opium and heroin, they flooded the market with very strong heroin, and you had a rash of overdoses because addicts who were accustomed to injecting scramble, which is 4 to 7% pure, were getting doses that might be 30% in purity. And if you inject a dose that's 30 or 40% pure, that you there's a very strong chance you won't be able to survive that. And that's why you had a lot of people dying.
Give us a sense of how many times heroin changes hands from the crop, the poppy crop, to its sales to individuals in American cities and suburbs?
Ooh, could be hundreds of times. Mm-hmm. I know that when I tried to follow it as closely as I could, and going to Myanmar, Burma as it's more popularly known, and trying to follow the trail, crossing borders and whatnot, and I just got lost because you can't. Probably, on average, about 100 times or so before it ends up being sold on the street.
And each time it passes hands, there's another profit that has to get made. So the markup's pretty extraordinary.
The markup is spectacular, more than 5,000-fold. When I met the poppy farmers in the mountains along the Burmese-Chinese border, they were selling raw opium, which they harvested, for just over $100 a kilo. And of course, by the time I ended up buying it with the undercover police in Baltimore, that same kilo will have generated sales of close to $1 million. And it is spectacular, the profits that are involved. And as you mentioned, every time it changes hands, because of the risk premiums, It increases in price, and you can really see where the big increases are, and that's when the highest risk is involved. When crossing the border in the United States, a kilo of refined 90% pure China white heroin, which is amongst the best heroin in the world, in Burma, is around $2,500 rather. It goes to 10,000 by the time it's in Bangkok. cross the border into the United States, and it's 100,000. So you get a tenfold jump just getting it into the United States, and then you know then the dealers and the wholesalers in certain places like New York or Chicago or LA sell it to crews, which then break it down to street crews, and it keeps changing hands and changing hands and doubling and tripling in price every time it does so.
My guest is Matthew Brzezinski. He wrote last week's New York Times Magazine cover story on heroin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Matthew Brzezinski is my guest, and he wrote the recent cover story in the New York Times Magazine called Heroin, the Sleek New Business Model for the Ultimate Global Product. Let's trace some of your steps. You went to Myanmar, Burma, to talk to poppy farmers. What do they tell you about why they're growing poppy crops?
Well, I think that they really don't have much of a choice. They live on the top of these mountains, where just about nothing else grows. And ironically, they started poppy cultivation about 120 years ago at the behest of British colonizers, who were looking to fuel trade with China next door. And the British introduced them to poppy cultivation and brought them up into these mountains where nothing else grows. And they've been farming poppy ever since. And now that there's increasing pressure, international political pressure, on Burma to crack down on these areas where they live, which in fact are areas run by warlords, just like in Afghanistan, where central authorities have very, very little say in what goes on. The farmers are very upset because they say, well, this is our livelihood, and they're not exactly rich. There's no running water. There's no electricity. The children run around barefoot. There's mud everywhere. I mean, you feel like you've stepped back into the 19th century, and they live in straw huts. And if you do take away this poppy farming, well, then they will all starve. They showed me corn. They're trying to grow corn. And the ears of corn looked like gnarly little kosher dill pickles. It just doesn't grow properly there. Nothing else does. So they're in quite a quandary. If you want to eradicate poppy cultivation, you have to then resettle tens of thousands of families and entire villages from the mountain areas of Burma, and that is politically and logistically almost impossible to do.
Do you think it's an issue to them that the poppy they're growing ends up as heroin that addicts teenagers around the world?
I don't think they have any clue. When they asked me, you know, where am I from, I said Washington, and they didn't know what Washington was. They had heard of New York, New York City. But they had never heard of Washington. You know, these are people who can't read, who can't write. In fact, in one village where I went, I was the first Caucasian that they'd ever seen. These are extremely isolated places. You know, just getting there, it took us 2 days of going over absolutely treacherous mountains, and they're completely cut off from the rest of the world, and they don't know. You know, what happens to opium and the effect that it has on people in the United States or in Europe.
So how much of the heroin that's cultivated comes from poppy crops grown by people like the people you visited in Myanmar?
Globally, almost everything.
Uh-huh.
I would say that 90% of the world's supply comes from people like this, whether they live in Burma, or they live in Afghanistan, or they live in the jungles of Colombia. I mean, that is a prerequisite for growing opium, because you need large tracts of land, and it's very difficult to disguise because of when poppy blooms, when the pods bloom, they have these very distinctive red or white petals, which in fact the DEA and the CIA use spy satellites, and that's how they measure what the acreage are, where it's all grown. But to do this, you know, you were very much exposed to then law enforcement, and the only places that this can be grown in is places where there is no law enforcement, where there are fiefs run by warlords, and these people are peasants almost like serfs from another age. And they do what the warlords tell them. And it's the warlords, of course, that make the money. And when I met the warlords in Burma, you'd show, you know, they would pull up in this convoy of $65,000 Lexus Land Cruisers. They would all have, you know, Rolex watches, and one guy had a gold-plated sidearm. And, you know, there you can see that, you know, they're clearly aware of where their drugs, where the drugs go and what effect they have on people, but they don't care because they're the ones who are making the money there.
Okay, so you met poppy farmers in Myanmar, Burma. Who do they sell the crops to?
Well, they'll tell you they don't know, which is nonsense, of course. But it's also the smart answer. They have to live there and deal with these people. It's generally speaking brokers who work on behalf of the warlords. In Myanmar, you have the Wa and the Kukang and the Shan. They're the three sort of ethnic tribes that are all run by warlords who have their own armies. And when I would enter their territory, they would have a formal frontier with a gate, and I would be met by all these people in jeeps and technicals with machine guns mounted in the flatbeds of the trucks and their own soldiers, and they would escort me. And you know, you can't get 10 feet there. If they don't want you there, you're not gonna last very long. They're very good fighters. And the reason that they can control their territories, these mountainous territories, is because the central government in Rangoon has tried for decades to fight them and lost every time. They're very much like the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, where they're almost unbeatable in the mountains.
So they buy the crops, and what part do they play, these warlords, in the manufacturing or the distribution of heroin?
Mostly just in the manufacturing. They set up these labs, and the labs are relatively simple to process opium into heroin. You really you need a 55-gallon drum. A source of heat and running water, and you can have the source of heat by just, you know, making a little fire and using a stream, and then some precursor chemicals, and the general rule is it takes 10 kilos of raw opium to produce 1 kilo of heroin, and there are different brands. The first there are different sort of brands or qualities of heroin that you can produce depending on how much you're refining it. But the first step is you produce morphine. From morphine, you'll produce a heroin base, which is often called heroin brand number 3 or brown sugar. From that, you add more chemicals and cook it one more time, and you can get the China White, which is the number 4 heroin, which is the top of the line heroin. And this is it's either the warlords themselves, or it's private businessmen who are then just paying the warlords, or, you know, or maybe the warlords are shareholders in some of the refineries, or they're just getting money purely and simple for protection. But the warlords do play a role in the first sort of steps into distribution, and that is transporting the heroin from the refineries to the borders of either Thailand or China. And this is rather something out of a movie how they do this. They have caravans that go through the mountains, and there's up to 100 people in a caravan. Sometimes they use mules as well, in which the heroin is attached to these in sacks to the mules. And it's done very much like a military operation, because the armies, of the warlord armies are involved, where they have advanced scouts. And when I was there a couple of days before I arrived at one of these border posts, a few of these advanced scouts had been caught, and when the Thai border guards refused to turn them over, the warlords started shelling them, and there was a mortar and shelling and howitzer exchange over this. So, you know, they're not kidding around. They're very well armed, and everything, you know, moves like a military operation.
Did you travel with a caravan?
I did not travel with a caravan because that is impossible, unfortunately, to do. I met a confidential informant that the Thai police had, who is actually a soldier in one of these caravans, and he described what goes on. And then while hanging out with the DEA, they had told me one of the firefights. They got into a 48-hour firefight with one of the caravans, in which there were no American casualties, but one American captain was actually bitten by a cobra. during the firefight and had to be medevaced for that reason. It's very rough territory, and it's the same, exact same process from in Afghanistan. Ironically, the Iran is fighting the biggest war on drugs on behalf of all of us in the world, and they're not getting any recognition. 3,117 Iranian border guards have died over the past few years in firefights with Afghan heroin caravans, and that is a very, very, very frightening border, the border between Iran and Afghanistan.
Why do the Afghan drug dealers want to get their stuff across the Iranian border?
Iran is both a demand. There's 2 million heroin addicts in Iran. And Iran is also a transit country to European markets and a little bit to U.S. markets as well, but it's mostly for domestic consumption in Iran. It's something that of course the clerics will not acknowledge in Tehran, but they have a very serious problem with drug addiction over there.
Matthew Brzezinski wrote last week's New York Times Magazine cover story on the global heroin industry. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Matthew Brzezinski. He wrote last week's New York Times Sunday Magazine cover story, Heroin, the Sleek New Business Model for the Ultimate Global Product. Brzezinski is a contributing writer for the magazine. Oh, okay, we've been tracing heroin from the poppy crops to its through its manufacture and distribution. So we've talked about the farmers who grow it, the warlords who get the crops and then manufacture it into heroin. Then warlords ship it out from the refineries. What happens next?
There are two principal pipelines by which heroin leaves Myanmar and enters the global markets. One is through China, mostly through the Yunnan province, and the other is Thailand. The Chinese pipeline seems to be the biggest and the most efficient, and it's ironic. It's also, unfortunately, the one that that U.S. law officials know the least about. The other is of course Thailand, and this is sort of the more traditional route, the one people know or have heard more about. And I tagged along with the DEA, who have an office just across the border from Burma in Thailand, where they sort of sit there and they wait for the drugs, and rode along with this huge former Marine who runs one of the offices there, and we had over $100,000 in cash and buy money, and then everybody was armed to the teeth, and they were trying to set up some sting operations with Burmese brokers. But essentially, the heroin changes hands at the Burmese-Thai border, and then Thais there pick it up and bring it to Bangkok, where again it changes hands, and there the international buyers come. And the biggest groups there are West Africans and the Nigerians, and they're some of the biggest importers of heroin into the United States.
You say that the West Africans have the riskiest job, which is getting the heroin into the United States. What are some of their approaches to doing that?
Well, there are a number of approaches they use. One is to bring the drugs into Lagos, into Nigeria, where it's repackaged. And into these pellet-sized pieces that are then put in condoms and then coated with honey, and they recruit people, and it could be from their tribes or family members, and then they get them bogus visas to come to the United States, either as tourists or work visas or whatnot. And the couriers, and they'll often send as many as 15, 20 couriers on the same plane. All with a kilo of heroin in their stomach.
Wait, I got to stop you here. So the sugar coated condoms, you swallow a whole condom worth of heroin?
You swallow up to. I give you an example. In April, a 13-year-old Nigerian boy got sick at LaGuardia, and it turned out that he had 87 condoms filled with heroin in his stomach, basically 1 kilo of heroin in a 13-year-old stomach, and 87 condoms. And he got sick and started passing them through his system. He survived. He didn't die. Of course, if one of these, just one of these condoms ruptures, you are facing certain death. And he was offered $19,000 by, of all people, his father, who ran a $33 million heroin ring in Georgia, and has been caught and sentenced to prison.
Wow. So after you swallow the honey-coated condom of heroin pellets, how do you get it out? It has to pass through your system? You have to defecate it?
Yes. You let your digestive system do its thing, so to speak. And the people who do swallow, they're called mules or body packers or swallowers, but these couriers are very, very difficult to catch, obviously, because even if you suspect that they have heroin on them, JFK Airport or most ports of entry do not have the special medical X-ray machines that you need. And then you need to prove some sort of cause, then you need to send them to a hospital where they can be X-rayed, and only then, can you determine whether or not they've ingested heroin in condoms. So the only time that they get caught is when something goes really wrong. And I remember talking to one customs official on the border with Mexico, while somebody was passing through customs, they got sick and started basically couldn't hold it anymore and started defecating. And the condoms started coming out while they were going through customs, and that's how they caught them. Or one of them breaks, and then somebody gets sick and they're rushed to the hospital. And then you find out, oh, look, their stomach is filled with heroin. But otherwise, you can't catch them. And let's say you do catch one. It's actually a very good way of spreading risk, because if there is a dozen people on one plane, and one gets caught, well, you're still getting 90% of your load through, and it's like paying a transportation tax or a tariff. If one person gets caught, so it's in one sense a very effective method of smuggling dope, but it jacks up the price tremendously, and this is why heroin is by far the most expensive opiate on earth.
Well, let me ask you, since we're talking about price here. The people who take that risk of swallowing the condoms of heroin, and the risk includes either getting caught or dying if the condom ruptures, and either way, you're really playing around with your digestive system here in a way that can't be very good. How are they compensated for it? Is this one of the more lucrative ends of heroin, or one of the more underpaid parts of it? Underpaid, I mean, comparatively.
This is actually fairly well paid. Mm-hmm. Aspect of the trade. You have to remember that the people they recruit to do this very often come from isolated little villages in very poor developing countries, where if you're offered $10,000 to $20,000 to move a single kilo, that is as much money as you can earn in a lifetime. And in a lot of those places, life is cheap, and the people also are not told of the risks. They don't understand that if a condom ruptures and the heroin enters your system, you will die. They don't need to know that. So there is no shortage of mules. And in fact, a great many of the mules that one sees, they're not necessarily swallowers. They usually bring in their briefcases, are Americans and Canadians and Europeans. And this is another one of the routes that West Africans use out of Bangkok. If they want to ship it directly from Bangkok to the United States, they often employ Caucasian mules. And this is sort of to throw customs people off guard. And often women are used for this. I don't know why, but they've sort of decided that women tend to be overlooked perhaps more often than men do at the border.
Did you get to observe any of the American-based parts of heroin distribution and sale?
I was fortunate enough to accompany the undercover police in Baltimore. Baltimore has traditionally been one of the biggest heroin centers in the United States. And one very senior officer there told me that out of a population of 600,000 for Baltimore proper, they once registered 60,000 heroin addicts. That is stunning. That is 10% of the population is addicted to heroin in the inner city of Baltimore. And I tagged along with the undercover police as they sort of prepared to go in and make and do a few of these sting operations that they do, the controlled buys. And it was quite an experience. First, we had to dress into costumes, and we were posing as construction workers, and we got dressed up in all kinds of, you know, dirty clothes and with paint all over them, and got into a beat up old pickup truck with scaffolding in it, and just littered with all kinds of garbage, and never in a million years would have I have guessed that the police officer I was accompanying was in fact a police officer. I mean, it was a very, very, very effective disguise, and we sort of went into the tougher neighborhoods. It's in fact very frightening that it seemed the main economic activity seems to be selling drugs in those neighborhoods. What's really sad is that looking at these young kids, I really was reminded of the peasants in Myanmar, who grow the poppy because really they don't have any other economic alternatives. It's the only matter of survival.
Matthew Brzezinski, one last question for you. If you don't mind my asking, you're the nephew of the former National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. And I'm wondering if in any of your journalistic travels around the world, people make that connection and ask you if there is any relation.
Certainly in the former communist bloc, yes, in particularly in Russia, where he was known as a sort of a great enemy, an adversary of the Soviet state. And in a few situations, it sort of led to some rather uncomfortable and chilly welcomes. And I remember one top former communist official in Russia sitting me down and saying, "Well, you know, maybe the children should not be held accountable for the sins of their fathers, but, you know, we know who you are and who your family is and what you've done to us." And I sort of laughed it off and found it amusing. But yeah, he's not, you know, in some parts of the world, he's not a very popular man because of his very hawkish stance on communism.
Well, Matthew Brzezinski, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Matthew Brzezinski wrote last week's New York Times Magazine cover story on the global heroin industry. He's also the author of a book about the new capitalism in Russia called Casino Moscow. It's just come out in paperback. This is Fresh Air.